You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and thanks for being here. And today I have the great pleasure and, I think, honor of speaking with somebody that, well, unless you've been living under a rock for a long time, you know the name Marianne Williamson. Marianne, well, I'm going to read her bio because I want to get it right. Marianne Williamson is a best-selling author. Excuse me, I'm getting over a something. Best-selling author, a political activist, and spiritual thought leader. For over three decades, she's been a leader in spiritual and religiously progressive circles. She's the author of 15 books, which is no small task. I collapsed after one, four of which have been number one on the New York Times bestseller lists. Williamson founded Project Angel Food, and if you haven't heard of that, you've been under that same rock, a nonprofit organization that's delivered more than 14 million meals to ill and dying homebound patients since 1989. The group was created to help people suffering from the ravages of HIV/AIDS. She's also worked throughout her career on poverty, anti-hunger, and racial reconciliation issues. In 2004, she co-founded the Peace Alliance and supports the creation of a U.S. Department of Peace. Williamson ran for the Democratic election for president in 2020 and is doing so again. And without any further ado, Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for being here and being willing to have this conversation. And I hope it's okay that that's how I see it. This is a conversation, and it'll take us where it'll take us. And you get to say anything you want. I want to say both hello again. I want to read this quote because it still surfaces as a Nelson Mandela quote. So our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of God. You're playing it small. Doesn't serve the world. Well, Marianne Williamson, two things about that. You're certainly not playing it small. And I love that. And were you ever able to meet Nelson Mandela? And
first of all, it's only an urban myth that Nelson Mandela ever even quoted that. He never did.
No, he never did. I mean,
he never quoted it. He never said it.
It's attributed to him.
No, well, he didn't write it.
No, I don't.
Yeah, and copyright laws and all that. That book came out in 92. He was inaugurated in 94, whatever. But the obviously, I would be honored if he had quoted it, but he simply never did. Urban myth. Don't believe everything you read.
Exactly. So. I think really what I want to start this conversation with let me just tell you a quick story, which is that last week I told somebody I know for a while who said I was thrilled, I'm going to be speaking with Marianne Williamson, and he sort of chuckled and he said, Marianne Williamson, why is she doing politics? I mean, what can she bring to the conversation other than like real honesty about what's going on?
Is that what he said? What could she bring
to the conversation other than real honesty about what's going on? So tell me, what are you bringing to this conversation other than real honesty about what's going on?
I think real honesty about what's going on is exactly what needs to be done.
Absolutely.
You know, James Baldwin has that famous quote, not everything that can be faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. Mm. And the narrative that emerges from the political system as it is one in which a serious discussion of what ails us, not only on the level of symptom, but on the level of cause, is peripheralized, even left out of the picture, is obfuscated. Why? Because the people who are creating that narrative don't want the population to recognize what the deeper problem is, because they are the deeper problem. For the last 48 years, we've had a $50 trillion transfer of wealth and opportunities that stem from that wealth that has gone from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1% of Americans. This is completely destroyed America's middle class, so that we are no longer really operating as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. We're a government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. So your traditional elitist political establishment doesn't really want to discuss that, because they are operating at the behest of those corporate entities that are donating what they donate to unduly influence our political system. And that is the deeper problem. The undue influence of all that money, particularly corporate money, is the underlying cancer under all the other cancers, to the point where our government is a system of legalized bribery. Until we address that,
you froze at the moment where you said, until we address that. So yeah. Until we address that,
so the most powerful way that we can override that, given the fact that it's not reasonable to assume that we will be able to overturn Citizens United anytime soon, or any of the other egregious factors that allow that system to remain in place, the most powerful thing that we have at our disposal is our own awareness, our own consciousness. And when enough Americans do awaken to the fundamental flaw in our operating system, and how that operating system has been hijacked by corporate money the way it has, and how dangerous that marriage of government and corporate power is, then nothing will fundamentally change. So somebody who comes in...
How should we address it?
Well, we have to address it in a lot of ways. First of all, it leads you to recognize what's really happening in this country. What we have is a matrix of corporate power that is really a reversion. It's a psychological as well as political reversion to what is basically an aristocratic system. This is what theoretically we repudiated in 1776, right? It used to be landed gentry. Today, it's corporate entities. So it's insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and big agricultural companies and big food companies and big chemical companies and gun manufacturers and big oil and defense contractors. And the way our government operates, more than not, one party much worse than the other. No doubt about that. Republicans much worse than Democrats. But that can't be our excuse forever, right? As long as short-term profit maximization for these huge corporate entities is placed before the health, safety, and well-being of the American people, of animals, of people around the world, of planets, the planet itself, then we're on a very self-destructive path. And that self-destruction is very real. And so we're like a ship headed towards the Titanic at this point.
Now, what do you say to people who say, well, yeah, but if you raise taxes on corporations or you insist on their wealth being transferred to, you know, higher wages for workers, healthcare for everybody, blah, blah, blah. What, you know, where does that money come from? They say you're going to tax the wealthy.
Well, first of all, let's take those one thing at a time. You know, in the 1970s, first of all, let's remember, in the 1970s, the average American worker had decent benefits, could afford a car, could afford a house, could afford a yearly vacation and could afford to send their children to college. That was in 1970s. We had a thriving middle class and a thriving economy. Mm-hmm. It's better for the economy. If you have something like universal healthcare, for instance, this is good for business. Get this off the backs of businesses to have to even think about it. And when I was growing up, Blue Cross Blue Shield was a nonprofit. For that matter, we had tuition-free college in this country, very, very small tuition for state colleges and universities until the 1960s. Every other advanced democracy has those things. Every other advanced democracy has universal health care, has tuition-free colleges and universities, has free child care, has family and sick leave, and has a livable wage. And many of those countries have economies that are thriving, actually, compared to ours. So a situation in which 20% of Americans, which is the case now, you have 20% of Americans for whom the economy is pretty good. You know, if you're in that 20%, then America's fine. The problem is that 20% of us are like living on an enchanted economic island surrounded by a sea filled with vast economic despair.
Yeah.
For that matter, when you talked about where do we get that money in corporate taxes, let's remember in 2017, there was a $2 trillion tax cut, and 83 cents of every dollar went to the highest earners and corporations, which they do not need. We're talking about corporations in most cases that are already making billions of dollars in profit. And, you know, the money is not trickling down in the form of job creation. And, you know, that myth needs to just be, you know, almost everybody gets that right now.
It's amazing how resilient that
that myth. My point is to repeal that tax cut is to repeal a tax cut that should never have been given. So it shouldn't be described as raising taxes. It's repealing a tax cut that should never have been given. Now, when that 2017 tax cut is revealed, the middle class tax cut should be put back because the middle class part of it was a good idea. And also a wealth tax. If you have $50 million in the bank, if we ask for 2% on a $50 million portfolio, let's say, and another 1% on $1 billion, the person who has that $50 million, the person who has that billion, will never feel it. Right. And yet that money could make a life-saving difference to the people who do need it. We have 68,000 people in this country who die every year from lack of healthcare. We have 18 million people who cannot afford to fulfill the prescriptions that their doctors give them. We have 85 million people who are underinsured or uninsured. In countries that have universal healthcare, you don't have medical debt. We have 1 in 4 Americans living with medical debt. People say, how do we pay for it? Look at what we're paying now. What's expensive is what we're paying now. And we're also not only paying for it economically, we're paying for it with our lives.
Well, it's expensive. And if for most people, I'm assuming, their experience is very much like from what I hear, their experience is very much like mine is that, you know, the first answer from the insurance company is no.
Exactly.
So even if you have it, the first answer is
exactly.
No.
Like, well, underinsurance, exactly. Underinsurance. Underinsurance at this point is as scandalous as lack of insurance.
Yeah, it's really.
But I think what we need to get back to, David, is realizing this is only because of profit making for the insurance companies. This middleman is not necessary.
Right.
You know, the fact that Americans are rationing insulin, this is only because of profit for pharmaceutical companies. The fact that we are ramping up fossil fuel extraction at the very moment when we should be ramping it down. This is only because of profits for big oil. And Americans waking up to this is what will ultimately change the tide.
Well, I hope you're right about that last part. And, you know, we shall see. You and I were both alive. Not that we're ancient, but you and I were both alive when the marginal incremental tax on individuals earning above X amount, which was up, you know, 90%, 91, I think it reached, right? And that seems absurd and outlandish right now. And maybe it is, I don't know, you know, but the idea of taxing, pick a number, people who earn more than $3 million a year, more than $10 million a year, more than pick a number. I don't know what the number is. You know, the economists can easily figure that out. Those dollars will be taxed. Above that will be taxed at X percent, 50%, 80%. And you say that, and people look at you like you're from Mars. And
I disagree with you. The majority of people do not look at you like you're from Mars. I know you're living in Wyoming now as opposed to Los Angeles. Certainly in Los Angeles, they wouldn't look at you like you're
Mars.
Yeah. Well, I know a billionaire in Los Angeles who once said to me, my taxes are so low, it's obscene.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you look at a lot of these issues, the American people are not the problem. If you look at issue after issue, the American people are a little left of center. The problem is not the consciousness of the people. The problem is how Washington works. The fact that people, even legislators, even when their constituents make it clear, yes, we would prefer common sense gun laws. Yes, we would prefer universal health care. Yes, we would prefer a livable wage. The legislators are still working in obeisance to their corporate donors
Why do you think people consistently vote against their concerns, their interests?
Well, I think that a lot of times the information, the dots have been confused. People don't even realize it. And I think also a lot of times, you know, in 2016, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump said to people, your rage is legitimate. I get why you're angry. I get why you're upset. You've been squeezed economically. You're living with chronic economic anxiety, and you have a right to be mad about it. The difference between Bernie and Trump was that Bernie meant it. And Bernie, if he had been president, would have done something about it, as opposed to Trump, who knew it was a thing to say. Because as his son-in-law had said to him, there are a lot of angry people out there. We could harness all that and make you president. Right. Now, here comes along Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton said, what we need to do is to continue with the success of the last 8 years. And people felt, what success? I'm drowning here. So, you know, I believe that you have to be honest with people and you have to be real and transparent with people. I think that the Republicans don't walk their talk, but too often, certainly for progressive Democrats anyway, they don't talk their walk.
So Marianne Williamson, why are you doing this? Like, you know, you're all those things that I read at the beginning. You're a best-selling this. You are a vital and active and vibrant 70-year-old. You could be. Well, you know, your days must be hellish, right? You've entered this world that is, the political world that is sometimes very ugly. And
I would throw that back at you. You're saying, why am I doing it? And really, sincerely, why are you even asking the question? Everything that we're talking about here spells the end of our country, David. Mm. Everything we're talking about here spells the end of our democracy. And you know it, and many of the people that are listening know it. This is not the moment for any of us to be thinking, well, hey, I could, you know, have a cool apartment in London. What? Like, why are we even talking that way? You know, Louis Brandeis, the late Supreme Court justice, said, you can either have large amounts of money concentrated in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy. You cannot have both. Mm. This is the end of our democracy here. When Lincoln stood at the battlefield at Gettysburg, speaking of the Union soldiers who had died there, speaking of the fact that battle turned the tide and made it seem that the Union would win after all, what he said was that those men had given their last full measure of devotion, he said, so that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from the earth. It's perishing. On our watch, it's perishing. We are not a government of the people, by the people, for the people, for all intents and purposes right now. We're a government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. We're not a functioning democracy right now. We're a functioning oligarchy for all intents and purposes. So how could any of us be thinking anything other than, well, how could I possibly help, and die happy.
Mm. Well, by the way, that's the answer to the question, why am I asking that question? I'm asking that question to get you to be able to say this. So
I've said it a few times, but
so good. I want to know if you feel like this entry into politics, not the most recent one, but, and I know that you've been involved in all sorts of causes over the years, but is this, I think a lot of people, I know this is true in the people that I know who know your name. A lot of people feel like, what? She's entering politics, or she has been in politics, or she's suddenly in politics. Is this a shift from the terrain you've been in all those 20, 30 years you were writing those books, and most known, I think, for your articulation of spiritual ideas? Or is this... Is this a next in the progression?
I don't think people are asking that. I don't think people are asking that question so much anymore. They certainly asked it in 2020. But at this point, I've run before. People get it. I wrote a book.
How do you see it?
In 1998, I published a book called Healing the Soul of America. In 1998, and in that book, I talked about the corporatocracy. I talked about race. I talked about all of these things. It's not like all of a sudden I woke up one day in the last few years. We talk about politics like it's a separate issue in our lives. But, you know, that's part of the problem, is that it's become this spectator sport, this idea that only a few of us, quote unquote, should be involved in politics. The word politics comes from the Latin root politeia, which means of the people. Now, in my own life, you mentioned Project Angel Food. I founded Project Angel Food and other nonprofit organizations. So I've definitely been a nonprofit activist. And I also have had a career where I was up close and personal with people going through very terrible times in their lives. But I started seeing around 2000, a little bit after that, which makes sense because it took 20 years for the full evil blossoming of trickle-down economics to be felt in this almost ubiquitous way by people around the country. I began to realize in the early 2000s how many people were suffering in this country through no fault of their own. Mm-hmm. And it was a result of bad public policy. And no amount of private charity can compensate for that basic lack of social justice. And so I also realized that policies were made that were making it so hard for people, people who were having to work two and three jobs, people who couldn't, get out from the shackles of lack of health care, college loans, all of that. And I realized that the system would then say to people like myself, oh, take care of those people, will you? I remember a politician when I was in Michigan saying, Miss Williamson, what do you think? Do you have anything to tell me about the mental health crisis? And I remember saying to her, yeah, why don't you stop driving everybody crazy? So, they call it a mental health crisis. It's an economic justice crisis. Mm. So if you are particularly talented, if you are particularly smart, if you are particularly gifted, if you are particularly advantaged financially, you can make it in America, pretty much no matter who you are. But you should not have to be the anomaly. You should not have to be the anomaly to make it in America. Anybody should be able, if they work hard enough, to have a dignified life and have a livable wage. And by the way, millions of the people who are locked out of that system are locked out before they're 10 years old. You have millions of American children who go to schools where they don't have the resources with which to teach these children to read. And if a child cannot learn to read by the age of 8 or 10, the chances of their high school graduation is drastically decreased, and the chance of incarceration is drastically increased. So what am I going to do? Like, buy an apartment somewhere? I mean, it's just, we've all got to wake up now.
So what are you going to do? Fast forward.
I'm running for president.
Yeah, I know. I'm running for president. What if you win? What are you going to do?
I'm going to be a damn good one. And I'm going to help this country. I think of it as kind of like a chiropractor. I'm going to give this country a chiropractic adjustment. I'm going to help initiate a season of repair in this country. I'm going to help initiate a new chapter in American history. I want to cut the cord with what it turned out to be a very malevolent, dysfunctional chapter of American history, dominated by neoliberal economics, dominated by trickle-down economics, crony capitalism, et cetera. And, then I'm going to turn it over to in the next election to some millennial because it's their time then.
Mm. I think it's super important that a woman become president.
Well, not if it's
not just you.
Some of them. No, I mean, it takes more than a vagina.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you said that last part. Yeah. One of the things that I think was super important about your run in 2020, you introduced a new language into the political discourse. And I think some people, and I don't know if it was the good language or a bad language, right? I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, the Tina Turner conversation, the question, right? What does love have to do with it? I mean, here's this woman standing on stage and talking about real human, everybody feels them, right? I mean, all those things that are up close and personal. And suddenly it's on a political stage. And I thought that was such an important, that in and of itself was like a planting of a good virus that.
Hold on, let's go back a little bit.
Yeah.
I talk the way people talk in the 21st century. Yeah. The problem, the
it
way
just doesn't
I
doesn't happen on talk, the political stage.
But that's the point. Their exactly. conversation is stuck somewhere like in 1987.
Right.
So right. What is really fringe is their conversation. It is completely transactional. It only talks about the symptoms. It's like this delusional la-la land where we're pretending that the economy is okay, even though 80% of people are living in constant economic struggle, where we're not going to talk about the genuine nefarious effects of big food companies and big agricultural companies. What's happening to our food? What's happening to our air? What's happening to our water? What's happening to our planet? Oh, we're not supposed to talk about that. And they're considered the reasonable adults. What are these people so proud of? You know, I think that's what really gets me about those who call me like out there. What are they so proud of? We are 6 inches from the cliff. We're 6 inches from the cliff in terms of the state of our democracy, the state of our economy, the state of our environment. I mean, the latest UN science report is like there's nothing we can do even at this point to avoid the catastrophic consequences of climate change. All we can do is seek to mitigate the effects. So I don't know what these people are so proud of. Now, this is the thing. This country is different than it was before the last election. In the last election, what I found, you know, running and talking to voters, you know, who would be voting in the Democratic primary, people had an understandable focus on let's just get rid of Donald Trump. I just want to get rid of Donald Trump. What we have found since then, much to the dismay of many of us, obviously, is that it was more like a tumor that in fact had already metastasized. So just getting rid of the tumor did not get rid of the cancer of hatred and the plague of mean-spiritedness that he had in many ways harnessed. Now, people, what I find, because my campaign is already on a roll, you know, we're already out there, I'm talking to people. People are more open now to the realization that something deeper is wrong than can be dealt with by simply some transactional old-fashioned conversation, particularly Gen Z, David. They're not even 20th century people. They don't feel that they should have to live their lives at the effect of bad ideas left over from the 20th century. And they don't talk like people stuck in the 20th century. They have a more holistic, whole person perspective on life. And so they don't find it weird when a politician does. They find it weird when a politician doesn't. And that's who has us like blowing up on TikTok and all of that stuff.
And do you feel like you're, well, obviously nobody's getting enough, but do you feel like you're getting enough exposure?
Well, I mean, the mainstream media.
Your days are probably really long, but.
The mainstream media is seeking to invisibilize me.
Yes,
I mean, it's ridiculous. But independent media, and I tell you, TikTok and all of that, I mean, that's where, you know, the kids are all right.
Yeah. Yeah.
TikTok has its own issues, of course. But
So I have a question for you that, you know, I don't know if it seems weird or not, but who inspires you? Like, who do you look at that is inspiring or somebody you admire? I don't know, whatever language that is that one uses.
Well, on a political level, Bernie Sanders, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of my life, my father and my mother, but my father was my father was really something. He was like a cross between William Kunstler and Zorba the Greek. And this is really big. My father was something else. You would love my father. So my father used to walk around the house when we were kids, beat the system, kids, beat the system, kids. And I think I was like in my 40s before I realized how serious he was. Now he actually meant it. He's been gone since 1994. I'm still trying to get his approval.
I get it. And what about your mom?
You know, my mother used to say to us when we were younger that a woman's most important job was to take care of her children and to take care of her home. So when she used to say that, I thought it was so and retro and regressive, and I wanted to go out in the world and do something meaningful. And you learn enough to know there is no out there. In here is as important as out there. And I began to see that what my mother was speaking to was a deeper archetype, and that there's a level of truth in it. It's just that our main focus should be take care of everybody's child, not just our own. And when we say we need to take care of our home, excuse me, not just our own children. And when we talk about taking care of our home, we have to realize the earth itself is our home. Yes. So I do think my mother was wiser than I realized when I was a young woman. I hope my daughter will have that experience someday. I think most
Yeah, we all hope those things. It's that's interesting, because she was pointing at those close up personal right here things that you just said before, so are so important to more and more people. And that's an interesting connection there. What'd you learn in 2020 that somehow you're you're putting into place now?
I learned that if you're going to be in the kitchen, don't complain about the heat. You're going to have a tough skin. Don't read Twitter so much. Haters are going to hate. Scorpions are going to sting. Don't, as my father would say, don't let the bastards get to you.
Yeah, exactly.
And I hope, and I believe I have learned something about, you know, a political campaign is a pop-up business. That's what it is. And
it's interesting.
Anything you learn from doing it the first time, right?
Sure.
Or the second time or whatever.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about a presidential campaign. I've been in the belly of that beast. I learned the system is even more corrupt than I feared. And I learned that people are even more wonderful than I hoped. And I'm seeing the same thing this time. I see how the system works. I see how the political industrial complex works. I see how they come after you. If you dare to have a conversation outside what they perceive as acceptable. But I've also seen how intelligent people are and how good people are if you speak to their talent and intelligence and nobility. You know, my father used to say, my father was a lawyer, and he used to say, talk to the smartest person on the jury. And I've always tried to practice that in my work, and I try to practice it in my politics as well. I don't dumb down the message.
Well, it's also
this is not, if I may say so.
No, please.
The political system trains people to think like seventh graders. If as Americans, if you and I are having a conversation about something, we get down deep and real as much as the people do in any other country. But when it comes to our public dialogue, particularly about politics, we all get stupid. You know, we all stop talking about real things. And reason for that. They train us to think in narrow-minded, sloganeering ways. I don't do that. This is not the time in American history for any of us to be thinking like seventh graders. And what I find is that people appreciate the adult conversation that I'm trying to introduce into the field.
The idea that you get pushback or mean-spirited people doing things is just an indication that you're having some effect, right? I mean, people don't go after you if you're irrelevant. Right.
So still hurts a little bit, but you know, not like it did last time.
Absolutely. Those slings and arrows definitely hurt, but I mean, is it Trump versus whoever? You vote for whoever? I mean, we don't need to turn this into a Trump session, but is it your sense that it is very important that he not be the president again?
It is very important that he not be the president again. It's very important that Ron DeSantis not be the president again, a president at all, the first time. It is important that no one with neo-fascist authoritarian tendencies become president of the United States. I'm not running to obstruct the process by which we push back on that possibility.
Understood.
I'm running because I feel that the agenda that I'm submitting to the American people is the way to defeat those forces. This is the deal. President Roosevelt said that we wouldn't have to worry about a fascist takeover as long as democracy delivered on its promises. And the problem is that democracy is not delivering on its promises. The reason that disease has had such a powerful effect on us was because we had a weakened immune system. When you have 80% of people who are living with this constant economic struggle, we have a weak immune system. So I'm the one who's saying that if we face the Republicans in 2024 saying, hey, the economy is good, which the president has said would be his message, when in fact that is contradictory to the visceral experience of the majority of Americans. Or if we say, hey, we've made it incrementally a little bit better here, we've made it incrementally a little bit better there, in 10 years, you're really going to feel it over here, that will not defeat the Republicans. The only way to defeat big lies is with big truth. And big truth is, you know what, things are not okay. They haven't been okay for the last 40 or 50 years, and we're going to make an economic U-turn. We need to do more than offer people an alleviation of their stress. We need to offer people fundamental economic reform. That is what my campaign is about, and that's what I would do or will do as president. Mm.
And so tell me about this Department of Peace.
Department of Peace. Well, right now, we have an $858 billion defense budget. We have a $6.9 billion, we have a 60-something billion-dollar State Department. And then we have something like a $6 billion USAID within that. Now, the USAID is what helps build people's lives and make them better. That conceivably has more to do with actually creating the conditions of peace sometime on this planet than does more capacity to wage war. John Kennedy said, we will get rid of war or war will get rid of us. So there are, just as you can't just treat disease, you have to proactively cultivate health through the way you eat, through your exercise, through your just the way you live. You proactively cultivate health, because sickness is the absence of health. Health isn't the absence of sickness. And same with war and peace. Violence is the absence of peace. Peace isn't the absence of violence. So there are factors which statistically, when they are present, indicate that there will be a higher incidence of peace and a lower incidence of violence. Four main factors of peace building. Number one, expanded economic opportunities for women. Expanded educational opportunities for children, reduction of violence against women, and the amelioration of unnecessary human despair. That's how you wage peace. And so a Department of Peace that gives as much credence to the capacity to wage peace is as important as making sure that we have the capacity to wage war if, in fact, we need to.
And all makes sense. But wait. But you're stepping into, you know, the world goes according to your hopes and dreams, and you know, you give your celebration, you give your victory speech, and now you're stepping into a world that, you know, hopefully it'll be over, but chances are it won't. The Ukrainians and the Russians are still at each other's throats. The Allies are arming Ukraine. What does Marianne Williamson do?
Well, the Battle of Bakhmut is raging right now, and it's going to say a lot. I basically support President Biden's policies in Ukraine, actually. If you're going to be an anti-imperialist, that means you're not only calling the United States on imperialist policies, but you also call Russia on imperialist policies. He is a brutal dictator. He is a brutal murderer. Right. And yes, did the United States make mistakes? Absolutely. Can we look at our behavior with NATO over the last few years? Can we look at our, you know, putting the Aegis missiles in Poland, et cetera, and say the United States has completely clean hands here? No, we don't. But that is nothing to me compared to the vicious behavior of this person's, Vladimir Putin. So there's a reason when you have something like Finland joining NATO, when Finland has been neutral for all these decades, that means something. I think a lot of times people here are kind of weighing in on what's going on over there from the safety of their Twitter account. You know, if you're a Latvian or an Estonian or a Lithuanian or a Swede or a Finn, you don't see it quite that way. Right. And so I take a more European perspective on that.
I think that that's one of those things that, my two cents, that's one of those things that people think, well, that, you know, what would she do? You know, the world is, I mean, here's, you know, the way it goes, right? I mean, the world is a mean place. There's some nasty people out there. And and they know Marianne Williamson as a voice of peace, a voice of compassion, a voice of love. And so there's that. I'm not saying that that's accurate. I'm not saying that that's all that's in your mind. But I think that there's the question mark in people's minds is like, yes, but how could that approach this very real world in which ugly things happen? And you know what you're doing much better than I know what you're doing. And but I'm hoping that that message gets out there that, wait, this is a serious human being who's thinking about things and is willing to say no when there's a no.
Yes, love does sometimes say no. Love is not just namby-pamby Hallmark card, you know, the goddess and, you know, chanting right. under the moon. You know, the force of real love has a fierceness to it, and it says no when no has to be said. And what you just said is true. The world is a complicated place, particularly when it comes to foreign policy. It's not black and white here. But there is a struggle between autocracy and democracy. And right now, I think what the United States has to face first and foremost is we have to build up our own immune system. We have to build up our own democracy. I had the honor of meeting the Dalai Lama a few years ago, and he said to me, the world does not look at the United States as the champion of democracy, which is the way we've been fed. So, the United States has decades of really bad foreign policy, even imperialistically and, imperialistic foreign policy. So if you look at something like the Vietnam War, if you look at something like the Iraq War, if you look at the last 20 years in Afghanistan, we have actually endangered ourselves in large part by diminishing our own moral authority in the world. So yes, we now live in a multipolar world. This is not a world now where the United States gets to just have it our way. And we're going to have to be far more humble, and we're going to have to find a way to collaborate with people that we don't necessarily agree with on many things. But still, we have to stand with our own values. And that has to do, in this case, I believe, with Ukraine, standing with Ukrainians, just as it has to do with standing with the Yemenis and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my last question for you is really just what do you wish people asked you? What do you wish I asked you? Ask me that question.
Well, I don't actually enter into an interview wishing anybody would ask me anything. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity to dance with you a little bit. And, you know,
What are your days like these days? Are you like, you know, early in the morning to late at night every day?
Yeah. But, you know, it took me over a year to think about really deeply whether or not I was going to do this again. It wasn't an easy decision. It had some somber moments. I knew it would be tough. I know how they treated me when they just thought I was an inconvenience. So I knew that the cannonballs that they've already started throwing at me would be coming. So I had to really think about this. But once I started, I'm in it, you know, that term, in it to win it. You know, it's like, it's a little bit like being on a tightrope. Somebody told me something interesting the other day. The most successful tightrope walkers have no net. And I thought that made sense to me, because you just can't even, you can't allow your mind to go anywhere other than, you know, and one man said to me something, a friend of mine said something to me, a couple of months ago, oh, this is hard, or they weren't nice, or whatever I said. And you know what he responded to me? He said, toughen up, buttercup. And that's what I needed to hear. That's what I needed to hear. I don't need to be, I get that it's tough out there, but right now the people who love me the most are saying, get out there, do it again, get up there, get out there. And that's what I'm trying to do. And yes, it's from early in the morning to late at night.
And do you imagine it's going to be a crowded field? Or is it just going to be you and Biden? Or do you?
I have no idea.
I
don't have any inside knowledge. My guess is as good as anybody else's. But I tell you this, I think that anybody who feels that they should run should run. I think the way that the DNC and those assorted forces are trying to clear the field as though they get to decide who the Democrats will nominate. That's like it's 100 years ago, a bunch of men sitting around a table smoking cigars. You know, candidate suppression to me is no different than voter suppression. It is a form of voter suppression. Mm-hmm. So I think anybody who feels called in their own gut and their heart, and they're going to put themselves out there and submit to the American people an agenda for the American people to think about, that's what's supposed to happen in a democracy where the people are governing ourselves. I'm saying my agenda is very different than Joe Biden's, and people need to think very deeply. What is the agenda that I think could beat the Republicans, and what is the agenda that I think would help repair America? And I feel very blessed as an American, very privileged to have the opportunity to do that. And I think the system should make way for anyone who feels moved to do that, to have a chance to do so.
And just to say it out loud, so people who do want to see that agenda, hear that agenda, should both listen to you and go to
Marianne2024.com.
Marianne, and I'll make sure I put that in the description and all that. So
thank you.
Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for being willing to come here and
thank
have
you.
This conversation.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
God bless you, David.
And onward.
Thank you.
Indeed. Take care.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.